As I think all of you know, the sign out front says Insight Meditation Center. And so the word insight is central to what we do in terms of meditation. Someone once said that to use the word meditation generically, like I like meditation or I don't like meditation, or I think meditation is dangerous or I think it's really great, is like doing the same thing with the word sports. You know, I like sports, or, you know, because you see football players getting injured on the field, you say, well, football seems like such a violent game. I'm against sports. And there's all kinds of sports, right? So it's all kinds of meditation. And so the kind of meditation that our center primarily teaches is called insight. So what is it that's insight? What is insightful? And that the word in Pali is vipassana, and passana means to see. And V is kind of the prefix V is kind of for emphasis, so it means perhaps to see in a special way, or deep seeing or clear seeing. So what is it to see? This week at home, we had a gathering of people, friends over and people over. And I was sitting opposite side of the room from my son, who was sitting with my wife and my older son. And at some point I noticed, I was looking at him, and I saw an expression on his face that seemed very unusual. And so I looked at that expression for some time. What is that? What am I seeing there? Am I seeing it from a different angle, you know, than I usually do? And am I seeing something about his character that I haven't seen before? What is it that I'm seeing? I thought, oh, this is. So I was looking. I was very, you know, I was certainly paying attention to him. Then later in the day, when we were kind of alone, my wife said, "Oh, did you notice what happened back then?" And I said, "No, I noticed it was an expression on his face, and I was studying it, trying to understand it." And she said, "Oh." Someone had done something just before that, which I had noticed, but I hadn't conveyed the connection, that had upset him quite strongly. My son had either frightened him or upset him. Someone had a little burst of anger that was over as soon as it was done, but it was in his direction. And that expression that I saw was my son kind of looking at my wife with kind of this frozen smile on his face, that he was trying as best he could not to cry. So I was really struck by this, that I had been looking at him and I'd seen something. But what hadn't I seen? I hadn't seen, you know, what was really going on for him. I knew to pay attention, but I didn't really see. What is it to see? What do we see? You know, how do we see? And you know, as a parent, I felt some responsibility to see him well. And that's part of the perspective of being a parent. You have certain roles, certain responsibilities to your children. So I felt, oh, I need to pay more careful attention to this. So I need to see this, you know, see this through the perspective maybe of a parent, how you respond to something like this. So there was a perspective I was bringing, but still I wasn't able to see what was going on. There's a story about a man who can't find his axe. And then he sees this neighborhood, a child walking down the road. And he sees that child. His child's walking just like a thief. Has the eyes of a thief. Seems to talk like a thief. Certainly that child has taken my axe. And sometime later, he sees, he finds his axe, you know, probably in his storage closet someplace, and realizes, you know, that, oh, he just misplaced it. And then a little bit later, he sees the same child walking down the street. And this time, the child walks like a child, carries himself like a child, talks like a child. So here again, you know, how do we see someone? Do we bring perspective? Are we influenced by certain kind of events or certain ways, certain predispositions to see in certain ways? And what is it like to clear our vision so we maybe perhaps we don't see through the filter of perspectives, of ways we have to see? And I think in meditation circles, like in Buddhist circles, there's a lot of emphasis placed on seeing things as they are. And that implies, in some people's mind, that it's possible to free ourselves from all the filters, all the different perspectives that we bring to a situation, and really see something as it actually is. But what is that? What does it mean to see something as it is? To see my son upset. I saw something there, and I had enough perspective to know that this is something to pay attention to. But somehow I didn't have the perspective or the memory to connect it to what had happened just before, or to kind of read him appropriately. Did it require having less perspective? You know, did it require kind of emptying my mind totally so I could see fresh? Or did it actually require seeing my son through some perspective, some understanding of what had happened just before, some history of what his face looks like at different times, and kind of picking up the subtle cues? And did it require some perspective I bring with me, or did it really require just letting go, dropping everything? We certainly know the problems that can arise when we see each other through perspectives which are false. And we don't, like the man with the axe, we kind of often will see people in false ways. And so there can be this emphasis in Buddhism on having beginner's mind, having a mind that maybe doesn't come with preconceived ideas, so we can see things afresh. And so we talk a lot about being in the present, not bringing the past or not bringing the future into the present, perhaps, or not being lost in the past and the future, just being with things as they are in the moment. And that somehow that gives us a truer perspective of what's happening right now. And I think most of you know that if you spend a lot of time planning and worrying about the future, often our vision of what's going to happen in the future is not necessarily a true perspective of the future, of what's going to happen. Often things work out differently. And often if we just stay in the moment with the experience, rather than anticipating what's going to happen, often enough the situation unfolds in a much more healthy way than if we're anticipating and planning and all these things into the future. Now with my son, he anticipates the future. I don't know why he does this, but he likes to know what's going to happen. Now I could sit him down on the cushion and say, you know, tell him something about being in the present moment and how useful it is, but it's not going to work for a six-year-old or five-year-old, he is. And he was this way since he was less than two. We noticed that he was much more settled at a very young age if we very simply told him, oh, today we're going to be doing X, Y, and Z. And he would, like, settle out. But if we didn't tell him that, he'd be kind of restless. So today he asked me, what are we doing tomorrow? And I said, tomorrow's a school day. Yes, he said, I know that. What are we doing after school? Because that's the time that's uncertain. After school. So do I just tell him, be in the moment, enjoy this day? I don't think I can tell my son that. Do I tell myself that? Gil, just be in the present moment. Don't worry about the future. Don't think about tomorrow. That's his problem. I don't do that. I got to think about tomorrow. I need to have that perspective. To simply let go entirely into the present moment, as powerful, as important that is, useful it is, it's not enough sometimes. Other things are needed. Here's a lovely quote, or column, by Adir Lara. And the title is, Be Here Now, But Not on Purpose. And so, I'm starting to resent being told to live in the moment. Hope she doesn't come here. A multitude of books glut the stores, all trying to bully us into applying this Zen insight into our lives. Oh, okay, it's a Zen people. When I hear such advice, I want to say, well, I was going to live in the moment, but now you ruined it by telling me to. I myself did a book called Slowing Down in a Speeded Up World, filled with hundreds of excellent suggestions from ordinary people for how to do just that, how to notice when you're happy. After I wrote it, I tried following the advice in it. I tried to pay attention to the warmth of the water as I rinsed dishes, to the sight of red roses against the blue sky, to the sight of wet clothes billowing on a line. I tried to remember to take my coffee out on the porch in the early morning and enjoy the light. The result was not a more serene, Zen-like me. The result was a more guilty me. I'm standing there fidgeting out on my porch, trying not to look at my watch, and be annoyed to find that I couldn't even take 5 minutes to enjoy the morning without wanting to be on the next thing, onto the next thing. Enjoyed the morning light. Check. If humans are truly meant to live in the moment, more humans would already be doing it. Moments come when they want to and leave when they like. Trying to live in the moment is like trying to be happy. It doesn't work that way. You can't deliberately concentrate on the richness of the feast before you without having the groaning table vanish as if Samantha, unbewitched, had wriggled her nose at it. Happiness likes to come in by the side doors. Moments like to just happen. Saturday, case in point. Bill and I had walked to the coffee shop, read the paper in the sun, then rode our bikes to Green Apple to buy as many Booker Prize-winning paperbacks as we could carry in our backpacks. On the way home, we stopped for grilled eggplant sandwiches at The Grind around the corner from our house and gloated over our books. On Sunday, we looked forward to another... I'll just skip all this part. The truth is, we humans come equipped with imaginations so vivid that our imagined or remembered moments are often precisely what enriched the moment as it's happening. I remember sitting in a beam of sunlight from an open window in a Parisian flat on an August morning last year, waiting for Bill and our friend Frank to come back from returning a rental car, and listening to Juliette Clerc song that I used to listen to when I lived in Paris at the age of 20. I was feeling absolutely happy in that moment, with the sun on my neck and the music and Paris waiting. I was experiencing the moment fully, but the moment was made up partly of the memories evoked by the song and the anticipation of a day walking around Paris with Bill and Frank. I was experiencing the moment fully, but the moment was partly made up of memories and thoughts about the future. Is that true? Does the present moment include the past and the future and our thoughts about them? If we have some simplistic idea of always being in the present moment and leaving out the past and the future, are we shortchanging ourselves? But then in meditation, we often are training ourselves to be in the present moment, to let go of the past and let go of the future the best we can. And it's true that in very good sessions of meditation, you can let go a lot of the mind that wants to think about the future and think of the past. And a tremendous amount of joy and satisfaction and enlightenment, liberation can come when we learn to free the mind from this obsession about the past and the future, or bringing the past and the future into the situation. And to be able to drop all the perspectives we have and have no perspective, in a sense, is one of the really liberating things about meditation. Does that mean that we're supposed to go around always having no perspective, or always not, you know, being in the present moment so there's no past and the future? I don't think so. It doesn't work as a parent with my son. I have to pay attention to certain things. I have to have certain perspectives. I have to anticipate what's going to happen. I have to remember the past to some degree. In order to really understand my son, I have to remember where he's been, what he's done, his background. And I have to think a little bit about the future for him. And that has to be included in really seeing who he is in that situation. If I'm going to see myself, do I have to see that aspect also? My heritage, my background, my experiences, my potential, what's going to happen to me? Do I have to include that in really understanding myself? And I would suggest yes. That's one way, an important way of understanding myself or ourselves. But there's another way of understanding ourselves, and that is that understanding that comes when there is no perspective. When there is no past and the future, just us in the present moment, in the simplicity of the present moment that needs nothing more. That's also another way of seeing ourselves. Could it be that there's different ways of seeing ourselves, each of them as valid as the other, but each valid in their own context and way? And I think sometimes people, and certainly religious people, like to fall into a kind of reductionistic mode. There is one way that's the true way. What I'm suggesting here is that actually there's different ways of being, different perspectives at different times. And part of a life of mindfulness is developing an appreciation of the different perspectives that we can have at different times, and then have the flexibility to go between them at different times, flow back and forth between the perspectives. I had another experience this week of being annoyed with someone. A little bit, maybe leave it at that. well, actually, a couple of people I was annoyed with. One was the person who made my son so upset. And but both people, then I wondered, with what perspective should I see this person? Should I see this person through the perspective of my annoyance? Should I see the person upset my son through the protective fierceness of the parent? Is it gonna, you know, protect my son at all costs, or kick the guy out, or I don't know what. Or, you know, what perspective you see someone? You see someone, oh, this person is annoying me, it's going to take a lot of time to kind of remedy the situation, and what a headache, I don't need this. And I'd rather just be left alone, thank you. So it's all about me. Or is there some way of seeing this person as being, this person's a jerk? That's a good perspective, isn't it? I don't think so. That doesn't really, it's not helpful for that person, not helpful for me. Well, what's the appropriate perspective of seeing someone who's annoyed me? One of the people that annoyed me was from out of this country, a foreigner to America, relatively new to America, actually completely amazed at how different America is from his cultural background. I mean, it's like, in order to get his kind of view of the world in America, you have to go back 100 years, perhaps. I don't want to say that it's backward, you know. But a very, very different perspective. And he was learning very quickly. He turned to my wife and said, Mrs. Gill. And everyone in the room kind of... and my wife said, someone said, my wife said, you know, said, oh, no, that's my wife's name. My wife's name is Tamara. And she said, well, that's Mr. Tamara. And that got his attention, and he realized that, oh, did I say something wrong? And, you know, he was ready to, you know, to learn very quickly. So here was someone in a very different culture, radically different culture than ours. And how, do I somehow take that into account when I understand how he, you know, was annoying me because of what he had done to my son? And how do I include that? And how does that affect how I see the person and the compassion, the concern? Do I include as part of the perspective the fact that he's such a good learner? He's learned so much in the few little bit of time he's been in this country, and he's really trying to figure out how it all works. And to, you know, do I include that as part of the perspective? From what perspective do we see people? So there's a quote that I have. It's from Walt Whitman, but I've heard other people. It's attributed to other people, so I don't know. If we read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each one's life, sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. Is that true? Do we take the time to learn someone? Do we take the time to bring perspective? Oh, if I really pay attention to this person, then I can see them deeply and all hostility will evaporate if I really see deeply. So the difference that inspired this talk was the difference between looking and seeing. You probably all know what looking is, but do you really know what seeing is? I don't think you know what seeing is. Because I don't think anybody knows, because seeing is something we're constantly discovering over and over again. To learning how to see is a lifelong activity. In any given situation, how do we see this situation? Looking is something you bring with you everywhere you go. You can look. But to see is situation specific. And so it requires being interested in this situation, stopping, looking more deeply, looking more precisely. You know, I'm looking where you're telling me to look, but I don't see what you're seeing, is an expression we might say. Look over there. Do you see it? No, I don't see it. Oh, yes, I see it. Or I see what you mean. When someone, you really kind of connect to what the person has said. Or I don't see it yet. So to see is see something specific. To look is just kind of turn the attention in a certain direction. Thich Nhat Hanh talks a lot about seeing deeply into situations. But there it's including the past, including the wider context that's brought it into being, that thing. So he loves talking about, apparently, holding up a piece of paper and says, when you see the paper, to really see the paper, you have to see the tree that it comes from. You have to see the people who cut the tree down. You have to see the mills that produced it. You have to see the truckers that brought it to here. You have to see the water that flowed into the roots of the trees. You have to see the sunlight. You have to see the whole world, in a sense, in the piece of the paper. That's a way of seeing, where you're bringing a lot of perspective to the situation. And you're enriching the situation by expanding this perspective to include a lot more. So to look and to see, or to listen and to really hear. What does it require to really see or to really hear? And certainly one of the things is the interest to see, the interest to really hear. What's being said between the words when someone speaks? How do we listen deeply to someone or to a situation? How do we see deeply? So it requires certainly interest in it. And it requires a certain kind of stopping, a certain kind of willingness to kind of let go of some of our agendas, some of our concerns, some of our kind of rushing ahead with activities, and listening. Take the time to listen. Take the time to see. What is this here? Take the time. Give someone the time to really listen to them. And I gave it to my son. And I saw him in his face, and I kind of gave him the time, took the time, I stopped and just focused on that for a while. But it wasn't enough, because I missed something. To see narrowly, very precisely, to take a big picture, and to be able to have the flexibility of going back and forth between them. Not to have just one perspective as being the right one, but to go back and forth. So in meditation, sometimes we can have very fine, refined, microscopic view of what's going on in our experience. And sometimes that's liberating to see that. Everything drops away. The past, the future, the room, our body drops away. And it's very, very precise what we see. At other times, trying to have that really, really refined focus misses the big picture. And it's the wrong time to have that find perspective. We need to back up and have a kind of wide-angle lens to see, get the big picture of what's going on. The trees, the sun, you know, the interdependent world that it's all part of. How do you know which perspective is the right one in any given time? I think there can be guidelines for it, but I don't think there is a simple rule book that says this is the right perspective. Part of a life of mindfulness is a life that kind of experiments and goes back and forth and is willing to take on different perspectives, willing to try different lenses to see what is most useful in a given time, and not to have one lens that we're always carrying with us all the time, you know, with what's going on. So here's a quote. The Dutch writer and philosopher Abel Hirschberg tells a story of a rabbi who, upon entering a room in his home, saw his son deep in prayer. In the corner, he writes, stood a cradle with a crying baby. The rabbi asked his son, "Can't you hear? There's a baby crying in this room." The son said, "Father, I was lost in God." And the rabbi said, "One who is lost in God can see the very fly crawling up the wall." So there's kind of here, I think, recommending kind of panoramic view that includes everything that's going on in the world. The mindfulness that includes the crying child. You don't get absorbed in some deep samadhi, some deep mystical union at the expense of the child crying nearby. You have to know the appropriateness. When is appropriate to get absorbed and lost in a meditative subject? And when is it appropriate to expand the awareness to include the world around us that's crying, or needs our attention? What perspectives do we bring to this life of ours? Here's another quote that I like. I used to read this a lot. I like it. I hope that you do enough. Another God quote. I should translate it someday for the Dharma. Maybe it doesn't work, but God decided to become visible to a king and a peasant and sent an angel to inform them of the blessed event. "O king," the angel announced, "God has deigned to be revealed to you in whatever manner you wish. In what form do you want God to appear?" Seated on his throne and surrounded by awestruck subjects, the king proclaimed, "How else would I wish to see God save in majesty and power? Show God to us in the full glory of power." A little bit of an arrogant kind of king. So God granted his wish and appeared as a bolt of lightning that instantly pulverized the king and his court. Nothing, not even a cinder, remained. The angel then manifested herself to a peasant, saying, "God deigns to be revealed to you in whatever manner you desire. How do you wish to see God?" Scratching his head and puzzling a long while, the peasant finally said, "I am a poor man and not worthy to see God face to face. But if it is God's will to be revealed to me, let it be in those things with which I am familiar. Let me see God in the earth I plow, the water I drink, the food I eat. Let me see God in the faces of my family and neighbors." God granted the peasant his wish, and he lived a long and happy life. May God grant you the same. So each of them asked for a different perspective on the ultimate. What perspective do you see the food that you eat and your neighbors and the cars you drive in? And what perspective do you see all these in? Originally, I thought that I should give a talk today on gratitude, since, you know, Thanksgiving weekend, but I decided not to. But that's a perspective too, right? Perspective of gratitude. Is that an optional perspective that comes by accident sometimes? Or is it a cultivated perspective that we bring? Is it one that we could use more often? There are so many perspectives that we can have. Are some perspectives more useful than others? The word in another word for kind of a seeing kind of word used in Buddhism is the word ditti, which means view. And there's a wrong view and right view. And part of following the Buddhist path is knowing what the right view is. And as I like to teach, the right view is the perspective which helps us free the world of suffering. Suffering of our personal suffering, suffering of others. What's the view that helps that? And there are probably various kinds of views, but that's a certain perspective we can bring. Are we interested in suffering? Are we interested in that which brings happiness or the alleviation of suffering? As opposed to, am I interested in my status? If I can figure out the right kind of job that I can make that much money, then I'll get the admiration of the people around me, and things will be great. That's a perspective a person can carry, right? Some people do carry that perspective. But there are other perspectives. What perspective do you choose to hold your life with, carry your life with? Joanna Macy offers in her book, World as Love or World as Self, four different perspectives that people, she says, kind of general perspective people sometimes bring to seeing the world. I don't know. I've never thought about them deeply. I haven't stopped to look at them deeply. But it's kind of maybe interesting just to kind of go through her four. One is the world as a battlefield. And this is where the world is a threat. The world is a place you have to fight. You have to fight for your own. You have to be competitive. You have to dominance, kind of dominate the world, dominate others, one-upmanship. There's all this, the world is a battlefield. And there's various ways there people have this view they carry around with them. If I'm going to get something in this world, I have to fight for it. And roll over other people. Or relationships are battlefields. You know, that if I could, if I could dominate that person, then we can have a successful relationship. The second perspective is that of the world as a prison. And this, the person feels burdened, oppressed by the world, feels like the world is kind of like trapped by the world or situation, trapped by a relationship, trapped by various, job or whatever it is. And we bring the perspective of being trapped. And so, or in prison. And so the goal then is to escape, get out of the trap, get out of prison. And there's certainly a lot of religions, including Buddhism, has in certain corners of the religion that perspective. The world is an unfortunate place to be in. The body is a bad place to be in. It's full of suffering, full of sin, or whatever. And the only way to have hope is when we can escape this world, escape the situation, escape this mind, escape, our circumstance, so we can find some place outside of the situation that we can be happy. So that's a perspective we bring. And if we don't see these two as being perspectives, then we see them, this is inherent in how the world is. The world is a battlefield. The world is a prison. That's how the world is. But if we see them as being perspectives that the mind has created and overlaid on the experience, then you have a whole different situation, because then you can say, oh, maybe it's not this way at all. Maybe there are other perspectives to understand my situation. Can I be creative now and see, are there other perspectives to understand? The fourth perspective Joanna Macy gives, the third one she gives, is world as lover. And this is where a feeling of intimacy with the world, feeling of cooperating the world, not feeling like you're a person who's dominating the world or superior in the world, or superior to others. It doesn't really work to be lovers, I think, right? Unless you feel some intimacy and equality and real sense of seeing and connectedness with the person. And same thing with Joanna, I think, suggests about the world itself. We can have that relationship to the world. The world is not to be exploited, dominated, or fought with, but the world is something to feel cooperatively with. Somehow we're in it together and feel a sense of intimacy, a sense of care, nurturing. That's a perspective we can bring to the world. One of being, she calls it being the lover. And she offers a third perspective, a fourth perspective, which is the world as self. And there's certainly a lot of religions in the world which have focused on that, sort of aspects of religions. And this is where we see a kind of, it isn't that we're kind of like, the lover is still kind of maybe dualistic, kind of like the lover's there and I'm here and we have this wonderful, relationship. But the world as self is not to see a distinction between self and other, the world and oneself. To have that kind of duality, separation of self and other fall away. And so it's so close so that if someone, I remember once having this perspective and I watched someone pull a leaf off a tree and I felt all this pain. Because from this perspective of oneness, it felt like that was happening to me. And that's the last one, the fourth perspective of the world as self is one that is very much cherished by some people. So that's what Joanna Macy gives, is those four perspectives. I don't know which one she prefers the most, but I think the last two at least is certainly better than the first two for her. What I'd like to offer and this is maybe the most important point I want to get across today, is that the contribution of Buddhist practice to this issue of perspective is twofold. One is, as I've said, a willingness to be creative and flexible with the perspective we carry. There's many perspectives we have, and not to be stuck on one perspective, but we're willing to experiment with different perspectives, to flow back and forth, not to take one way as being the truth. In different situations, different perspectives are probably the most useful, the most helpful, the most appropriate. So that's one, to have, be flexible about perspectives we carry. But the second one, and this is where mindfulness practice becomes very important, is having the perspective, having the mindfulness, having the ability to see when a perspective is operating. To see the birth of a perspective, birth of a viewpoint, birth of a view, birth of a bias, and see how we overlay that on a situation. To watch the activity of the mind that creates a perspective. A perspective is an activity of the mind. The difference between looking and seeing, the seeing is a mixture of perception and thinking. Perception and cognition that we bring into play with the seeing. So there's an activity of the mind that comes into play, and then mindfulness is helping us to see how that activity comes into birth. So someone walks in the room, and the person is who the person is. But because that person is really big and burly, like a big football player, or something like that. And because I've had bad experience with football players. So this big person comes into the room, right? And then if I'm attentive enough, I can watch the seeing of that person come in the room. And I can watch the mind creating, oh, that's a dangerous person for me. The mind makes that thought, that activity. And I can see the birth of that activity. I know that that activity of the mind, that cognition, that thinking of the mind, perspective, resides in my mind, not necessarily in the person who's walking through the door. It might be, but it might not be. Chances are it's not. And so then, because I can see the perspective operating, then I have some choice about how to relate to that perspective. Not to cling to it, not to take it as necessarily being true, to give it the benefit of the doubt, perhaps, or give it kind of test it a little bit, or look more carefully. And is this a perspective that's useful? It's useful if the person's really dangerous, but it's not useful if the person's not. In fact, it could actually add a lot of suffering to many people. So let me take time to find out whether this perspective is accurate or not. Let me go and talk to the person. Remember what happened here? Actually, I remember the story here. We had this meeting here about a year ago of about 15 or so senior teachers from the Zen Center in San Francisco. And we're all sitting around, and most of them have shaved heads, you know, and wearing black and all that, or whatever. And our front door was open. And I don't know if I'm sorry, this is not necessarily a story illustrating much, but it comes to mind. And this person walks through the door, it looked a little bit unusual. If I say unusual, it doesn't offer a lot of perspective, right? Just it's kind of maybe a safe thing to say. But it seemed like a person who needed attention. So I got up, since I was kind of the host here, I got up and walked over there. And it felt like it was a person who it was appropriate to make real contact with. Even though the person felt dangerous. But I felt like, this person, I have to make sure there's real contact here. So I walked right up to the person. And I don't know if I said anything or not, but almost immediately, the person went like this. Zen! And turned around and walked away. What perspective? I've never seen the person since. What perspective is the right perspective to hold that little story? I chose not to have any perspective. Just let it be. But to see the birth of a perspective, to watch that activity of the mind. So rather than thinking we have to escape from all perspective or be free of all perspective, I think that what mindfulness is trying to train us to do in the context of perspectives is to be able to recognize when a perspective is there. And in the recognition of it, learning to be free. And that is probably enough. May you enjoy your perspectives. May you learn to see deeply. And may you never think that learning to see is a done deal. You're always learning to see, and I hope you stay interested in that learning. Thank you.